My only advice, stay away from mirrors. Mirrors are not good.
Mirrors are awful.
Avoid mirrors.
Yep. Do not look. When you go to the bathroom, do not look in the mirror.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
yeah. That's in the book too.
Really? Yeah. I'm curious now. What's that all about?
It's just.
You remember Raiders of the Lost Ark at the end?
Oh, no.
They open the ark?
Yeah. Oh, no. That, like, your face melts? Oh, no. That's terrible. Oh, yeah.
Everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Space Tomatoes podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Havoc, and we've got
the other host. Hi, I'm Alex. How are you
today?
Welcome back and all that stuff.
Awesome. And today we have a special guest with us, Diana Colleen, award-winning author of They Could Be Saviors. Welcome to the show, Colleen. Diana, sorry. Gosh.
That's two first names
right off the gate.
It happens.
I couldn't even hold it together for like 30 seconds. Oh my goodness.
Good job, host number one.
Right. We'll forgive you.
You're fired.
I know, right? Fire myself.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate being here.
Absolutely. So what brought you to, what brought you to write this book?
A life full of trauma and sorting out my own trauma using psychedelic assisted therapy. And that basically brought me into the psychedelic world, and I became a trained facilitator. And I also learned tools like meditation through, like, when I was in my suicidal period, I learned meditation. And probably 4 years ago, this idea just kept coming up in meditation about this fully formed concept of a book, just kept knocking at my brain saying, hey, write this book. And I'm like, I don't know how to write anything. I've never written anything in my life. And I'm like, no, you got the wrong person. It's not me. But things kind of worked out. I was in a job that I hated, and my partner at the time was like, you know, you're so unhappy and you've got this idea. I can support you. Why don't you quit and write this book? And it's like, wow, that was a leap of faith. But I did. I quit my full-time job, and I sat at my desk at home for 8 to 10 hours a day, and I wrote, and I learned how to write. I went, like, took so many classes and courses and joined critique groups and learned everything I needed to know, and now I have a book. So it wasn't planned.
Awesome. Yeah. So the psychedelic facilitator.
So, I knew you were going to go right to the psychedelics.
Well, come on.
Most people do.
Let's talk about the interesting stuff. Not that your book isn't interesting, but I mean, come on now. So I guess my first question is, did you have experience with psychedelics prior to using them therapeutically? And not to say that it isn't, in my opinion, therapeutic in general. However, and when you did embark on that journey, did you do it in a guided way with a mentor or in a specific setting or group, or, you know, how'd that work for you?
Yeah. So, like, growing up, I grew up in the 80s, and so the war on drugs was a big thing, and I was very anti-drug and all drugs are bad. I grew up with that mindset. So that didn't really leave me until I was, like, in my 40s. And so when I heard about psychedelic assisted therapy, I was like, oh, I was terrified of drugs. And so, but I did a lot of research, and there's a lot out there that shows how beneficial it is. And I was like, I need a lot of help, and I think this is what can do it. So I really didn't have a lot of experience with drugs prior to finding a psychedelic therapist. That being said, I did an ayahuasca ceremony, prior. Like that, an ayahuasca ceremony was my very first drug experience, and I don't recommend that.
Yeah, that's yeah, jump in with both feet. Let's go. Here we are.
Yeah.
Learn to swim? No, we're scuba diving.
Yeah, pretty much.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. And so the ceremony, I assume you probably went South America somewhere and did one of the, you know, kind of guided sessions.
Yeah, sort of. So I, what year was it? 2016, I think. I moved to Costa Rica by myself and was living like in the middle of nowhere, in the mountains, didn't speak the language. I don't know what I was thinking, but, somebody I met introduced me to a shaman, and they happened to be having a ceremony in the middle of the jungle, like a week from when I met the guy. I'm like, okay, I'll try that. So it was not like at a resort or anything like that. Yeah, very unplanned.
Wow. I struggle myself with like anxiety and social anxiety, and I've never tried psychedelics because honestly I'm worried like something would go on in my mind. Like I don't want to see demons. I don't want to like have those experience. I don't want to wear the chicken suit and walk around and do any like these things you see on the internet. I'd be worried somebody in the jungle is gonna like murder me. How do you get past those feelings? Just the anxiety of that stuff happening.
That's very real. That is so real. For me, I think it was just that I was struggling so much mentally that like, I don't think I cared if I died, you know, like, oh, right. Well, I wasn't happy in my life anyway. So taking that risk didn't seem as big because I really didn't care. If that makes sense. So
yeah, I think
hopefully, you know, you're not at that place because that's not a great place to be at.
Right.
Yeah. I think, the only harm I think that, you know, okay, let me take that back. I've gone through a couple of sessions where friends have had bad times, but temporary. I think the only real permanent harm that comes is to that fragile little three-letter system inside of us that gets destroyed pretty badly, and that's your ego, right? It really, and that, I think, is where the profound changes come from.
Yeah. There are risks, though. Like, Alex, you are very... correct. There are risks that you can have a psychotic break. And because I am a facilitator, I know these things that I wish that everyone would get screened before they do any kind of psychedelics, because there are contraindications and there are certain people who really should not be doing psychedelics because they can have an experience that they don't come back from. And that's probably what you're thinking about, Alex.
Could you go over it with us, like possibly, and let like who shouldn't dip their toes into the whole psychedelic thing? Is there like any
if schizophrenia? Like if there's any schizophrenia in your close family, don't touch the stuff. Bipolar, you know, definitely just talk. There are doctors that you can like. Do an online screening with that will, you know, they'll ask you all about what medications you're on or have taken in the past, your family history. So it's really important to have a screening before you do with any of this stuff.
Makes sense.
Oops.
Yeah. But in general, they're very safe. They are very, very safe. Most people, you're not going to overdose and die. Like psilocybin, you can't overdose on psilocybin. It's kind of like marijuana. You can't overdose. You can have some pretty shitty experiences by taking too much, but you're not going to die.
Yeah, I don't.
I completely relate to what you were saying because I still have my elementary school picture that I have the Just Say No shirt that they gave everybody like Yeah. You know, in school back then, it was pushed pretty hard upon people.
Oh, and yeah.
My wife talks about it all the time, that, you know, like, that's what they hammered into our head, that, you know, that you take the
egg
once,
in the frying
just
pan
just yeah. once, and you're gonna, you know, like, something horrible is gonna happen.
Yeah, you're gonna jump out a window.
We had the was it Dare? I don't think it was Dare at the time. It was the, you know, Nancy yeah. Reagan, you know,
Nancy just Reagan, say yeah.
no. Mm-hmm. We had, mm-hmm. had the officer yep. come in with this little tackle box full of goodies. I guess I got the wrong message and thought, oh, well, you know, this is an instruction manual? No, probably.
Did you ask for samples?
That was probably that close to doing so, to be honest with you. Yeah.
Nice.
I think, so after your first experience, was there anything the next day that really stood out to you as being visibly or recognizably different?
So are you talking about the ayahuasca or my first session with a therapist, the one that saved my life?
I would say, I'm not as familiar with ayahuasca. So let's go with the first session with a therapist, because that's where I would hone in.
Yeah. So at that point in my life, I was suicidal. The first therapist that I was referred to couldn't get me in for 6 months. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to be around in 6 months. And then he referred me to somebody else who was training under him. So she didn't have as much experience, and she could get me in pretty quickly, thank goodness. So going into that session, I was ready to not be here. Coming out of that session, I was okay staying. So, like, that's a huge shift in a short amount of time.
Oh, yeah.
So it literally saved my life.
Yeah. I think, yeah. So for me, I guess I could say this. I can say this. I can own up to this. Yeah. For me, it was, you know, I was young. I was a teenager with my first experience. And it was so recognizable and noticeable to me. I wasn't, you know, I mean, sure, troubled teen, right? But yeah, I don't think there was anything profoundly, you know, off. Well, maybe, I don't know. But I remember we took LSD and I remember taking it, and then about 20 minutes later, I'm like, yeah, it's not doing anything. It's not working. So I took two more. And,
oh, no.
And then my buddies took it. And then we're like, you know, 40 minutes in, we're like, it's not doing anything. So we're like, all right, well, let's get out of here. So we got in the car and we get on the freeway, and we're about 10 minutes into this drive on the freeway, and I just started laughing. And I mean, like, could not stop, like, uncontrollable laughter. And the two friends that I had with me in the front seats just both looked at each other and went, oh no. we got where we were going, and everything was good.
But good.
The interesting thing for me was the next morning, I remember it as vivid as anything, is, excuse me, I woke up and it just, everything seemed different to me. And it wasn't until I was on my way to, I was on my way to work, I was catching the bus, and I get on the bus, and it hit me. All the colors of the world were 100 times more vibrant. I was completely off, right? I mean, it doesn't, like, there's no real residual effect for psychedelics, right? Once you come down and you're done, it's gone. It's just gone. It's like it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking that, and it was just such a profound change for me that the world had become more vibrant, more alive, more detailed, more colorful. I guess maybe it's something that you did see or did experience, but it was overshadowed by something that was far more beneficial and necessary in your life at that time, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, like the therapeutic session, you know, is in a very controlled setting. So like on a bed with an eye mask, and you're going inside, so you're not experiencing outside.
Oh, okay.
But I have definitely had those like, you know, I've been in a forest on mushrooms and watching the trees breathing and seeing how everything is connected and how I'm connected to the trees, and that's something like you can't unsee that. Yeah, it's gone after the experience, but that lives with me. And like psychedelics for me, and I think for a lot of people, they connect you to nature, which I think society is lacking. Like we really need more connection to nature. It connects you to humanity, and it connects you to yourself. So like three major things. Like I feel like disconnection is one of the worst things in humanity right now, and psychedelics connect you to those three things. That it will change the world if people can have that kind of connection.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think it's it is an amazing thing that we're starting to see, actual medical professionals utilizing psychedelics for treatments. And some of the results are astounding, right? People that have, gone through the ringer and, been on, gobs of psychotropic medication and everything else, getting to a place after one session to where that medication is no longer something that, depending on the scenario, depending on the person, there's all sorts of different things. And I would never want to make a blanket statement. And for crying out loud, if you're looking to me for medical advice, just don't. Okay. But, to see some of the statements, with people coming out of that and people getting off of those drugs, which we all know have side effects and all sorts of other areas that I think at least warrant caution, right? And from something that has, very, very, very low possibility of any adverse effect and wears off out of your body, doesn't have an addictive profile, which is another thing that's quite amazing about them is, there's this reset period, right? People think, oh, well, I might get addicted. You can't. I mean, look, if you take shrooms and then you come down, you start taking more shrooms, you're not going anywhere. You're
they
just
don't do
eating
anything.
Really horrible tasting mushrooms and you're going to eat a lot of them and they're not going to do anything. And the same is true with LSD and peyote and, as far as I'm aware, all of the different psychedelics, they have this reset time. So it's not like you can even get to a point where, oh, I need, I got to stay on my... It's not. And then seeing some of the, what's referred to as microdosing and how that's been impactful to people with everything ranging from, ADHD to OCD to, just anxiety.
PTSD.
Yep. PTSD, anxiety is amazing.
Addiction. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like the possibilities for our war veterans with PTSD, like the VA is doing clinical trials right now to hopefully get the FDA to approve these drugs for therapeutic use. So PTSD and addiction, I mean, the homeless situation, like we can solve that if these people have access to this type of therapy.
Yeah. Didn't our government invent LSD, or am I thinking of something else?
No, they didn't. But
no, I thought they gave it to like people back in the day to see just like what it's going to do.
They certainly did.
There
that.
Were lots of studies. Yeah, oh, there were lots of studies. Yeah,
some of them without willing participants.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's
yeah,
what you're thinking of, yeah.
Yeah. Now that is messed up. By the way, don't ever do that to someone. Yeah. That is a terrible, terrible thing. Unless it's me, in which case, fine.
Mm. So if one decides after their own research that this is something that they want to delve into, how would you go about finding a professional? Because I'm sure there are legal ramifications depending on where you live and all that stuff. Yeah. And you can't just go down to Walgreens and pick the stuff up.
So right.
How does that work exactly?
It's getting a lot easier. So like when I first was introduced, it was really underground. So like you had to know somebody who knew somebody, but it's opened up a lot. So like the person that I trained under has a website, and you know, she lists pretty much all the people who have trained under her, and they're all taking clients. So like you can go to her website and choose somebody. But you know, that's mostly in Seattle, and Seattle is, you know, right, different than other places in the country. So like Oakland, I think, is decriminalized. Colorado and Oregon are way far ahead. So, you know, if you're willing to travel, it's easier in certain places. But even in places that you wouldn't expect it to be as prevalent, if you have just like a normal therapist that you see, start talking to them about it, because a lot of therapists actually do it on the side, but they don't talk about it. Okay. Because they wait for their clients to bring it up before they actually start talking about it.
Mm-hmm. I have heard things about ketamine therapy. Is that separate or is that legal, included in this too? Okay.
It is. It's considered a psychedelic, but it's completely legal. And that's a great place to start, because ketamine has very, very few contraindications. So most people can do it without worrying about what medications they're currently on or what their family history is with mental illness. So that's a really great place to start.
And that would be under a physician probably, right? At least where we are, I think, in Florida, I think it's under the direction of a physician.
If you get the intramuscular injections, it has to be done with a physician. You can go online, which I don't know how I feel about it, but like the lozenges, where you actually do it on your own at home, sort of under the supervision of somebody online, that's a little sketchy to me, but it is a possibility, and I know that some people have really been helped by that. I would prefer if you find a facilitator who will sit with you while you take it, but you can get the prescription online. Okay. Yeah.
So how does that work with the facilitator? I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask how it works with the facilitator. Do they just like kind of walk you through the whole process from start to finish? Because from what I've heard, I've never personally experienced it, but most psychedelics are kind of like a investment in your time from what I've heard, that it's not just so it's not over quickly, that you got to kind of ride it out to the end. Quick.
Like DMT is really quick. DMT is like a 15-20 minute experience.
Oh,
and you can drive home. Yeah.
Wow.
And ketamine, depending on how you do it, like the lozenges might last anywhere from 40 minutes to like 2 hours. So that's a shorter experience. But yeah, like mushrooms, LSD, MDMA, that's a whole all day thing.
That's probably what I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah. So when we talk about a session with a psychedelic facilitator or psychedelic therapist, it's usually you have a couple of like talk therapy sessions, like a couple 1 hour sessions with the person to get to know each other and talk about why you like what you want to get out of the experience. And then you have the full day under the influence of whatever substance the facilitator thinks is going to benefit you the most, like depending on what you're dealing with. So you have that full day experience, and usually there's not a lot of talking. So it's very inside. You lay back with the eye mask. And like for me, the only time I talk is when I want them to write something down for me, because some people really enjoy writing while they're under the influence. For me, it kind of takes me out of the experience. So I just write this down, and they write it down for me. And unless you're really stuck in something, or you're experiencing something that's really hard for you to get out of, they're there to ground you, bring you back to reality, keep you safe, so that you know that, okay, I'm still in reality. They just kind of get you through tough spots, but it's not talk therapy. Then after that day, usually, hopefully within a couple of days of your big experience, you have another session with them, and that's your integration session, where you talk about what you actually learned and how you can change your life based on what you learned. So the actions that you're going to take based on your day.
Is that what would be considered a heroic dose that they use, or is it more of a, you know, maybe 2 to 3 gram type of a situation?
It's typically a lower dose. The heroic doses, I'm not opposed to that for like a mystical experience. You want to meet God, you want your ego to totally dissolve. I get that. Like, that is definitely, you know, I think that's very beneficial in itself as well. But these therapeutic sessions are more for trauma. It's like, so the lower doses are more introspective, okay. if that makes sense. You're really like looking at who you are, why you are the way you are, what happened in your life, and how to move forward.
Interesting.
I have so many questions. I find it fascinating.
Big fan of the heroic dose reset myself. No,
of course you are.
Well, no, it's not. So it's one of those things that, you know, I think that doing that, and I call it a reset, is really what it is. Internalize and let things build up, and, you know, I start to notice things about myself, how I am, how I'm interacting with others, how I'm spending my free time, just little things that start to build up, I guess. And it doesn't, you know, it's kind of like, the whole social media thing, right? Like doom scrolling, right? And you sit there and you doom scroll, and the more you do it, the more you start to recognize how you're like, you're anxious and you're tensing up, and I'm all, and someone says, "Hey, you want some coffee?" "What do you mean, do I want coffee?" And I was like, whoa. And the reset for me, doing that heroic dose, really allows me to dissolve that ego and really internalize, what are these things? What do I need to let go of? And for me, it really allows me to almost go into the warehouse and look at all the compartments and expose those things and go, yeah, this has got to come out. I got to pull this one out. I got to open this one up and get rid of it. You know, it's like a spring cleaning, if you will, for my mental well-being, my spiritual well-being as well. Right. I really do believe that there's a lot of that that comes in. I don't really get that same thing when it's a lower dose. It's more of a fun, happy-go-lucky type of a time. Although I'm also not doing it in a more medical setting where, you know, things are more controlled and we're trying to do that. It's right. You know, a little more, you know, when it happens, you know, a little impromptu, I guess. So, I kind of really enjoy those myself. I've gone absolutely way past where I would suggest anyone should go, many, many times. I'm weird, but I don't know. I don't think that's the reason.
When you say dissolve the ego, what does that mean exactly? Like, I'm just not that knowledgeable. Well, what does it mean for you? Maybe would be the better question.
For
me.
Havoc. Yeah.
So I want to take these things and I want to compartmentalize them. We do this with everything in our life, right? We compartmentalize it, but there are some things we don't want to touch. It's not comfy. It's not cozy. I don't want to look at it. I don't want to think about it. And I certainly don't want to feel that. So I shove that way at the back of that corner of that, and I stack all kinds of boxes around it with other stuff that's way more comfortable.
Like my garage full of garbage?
Yes, but only like one of the boxes has a bunch of pit vipers in it, and you just leave it back there because it's protected with all these other boxes, right? And what that really means is getting rid of that ego that doesn't want me to take that on and suffer that kind of, and really be able to examine that, even though it, you know, honestly can bring about times where I go into, you know, almost hysterical crying, right? But I come out of that and that box is gone, baby. It's not like I opened it up, peeked inside, had some, radical emotion and then shoved it back. Like I can't, you know, it kind of dissolves the ego, and that's the part of you that doesn't want to deal with this because it is hurtful, it's shameful, it's, you know, it's impactful to your pride, it's impactful to any of these things that our ego centers around, right? And so the dissolving or the dissolution of that ego for that period of time really allows you, and sometimes even brings these things to the front. Like it just comes scooting out of that room right in front of you, and the box opens up and you're like, dang it. But that's what it is. And so it allows me to reset, and I can get all those maybe not all of them, but I can get some of those boxes out of there and dissolve, get rid of them, right? Just go ahead and deal with them, and then they don't have to go back.
Yeah, so like psychedelics they take away your fear. The fear of examining yourself, the fear of for me, trauma, you know, like talk therapy never worked for me because every time I went to talk therapy, I was re-traumatized just by talking about it. Like you can feel the trauma in your body when you talk about it. And the psychedelics takes that fear away so that you're not feeling it in your body. And you're looking at your life and yourself, everything that's happened to you from a very different perspective without the fear. And that's how, like, I think that your description was fantastic. And that is the therapeutic, like your heroic dose sounds very therapeutic. So like when I think of a heroic dose, I'm thinking meeting entities, meeting God, you know, mystical experiences. But your heroic dose sounded exactly like what a therapeutic dose does.
Yeah. Only you don't need to be in that controlled environment because you've taken enough to where it's going to happen, whether you like it or not. So you get both, I guess, right? And it's a good mix of the two for me as well, because I really enjoy the visuals. Like you said, that when you look out into nature, it doesn't happen if you're in a house. It doesn't happen if you're in a room. But if you're in nature and you look out, literally everything is completely intertwined and connected. You could draw a line from whether it's gears or swirls or whatever you happen to be visualizing, but it's usually one of those two, swirls or gears. Don't ask me why, but it is. And you could literally draw a line from a tree branch down the tree through the swirls into the ground onto a rock and, you know, even up into the sky and the clouds and the stars and everything. And it just brings about this feeling. And then if you look down at your feet, the swirls come up into you and go out from you as well. And it really brings about that it's a feeling. It's not just like a thought, like, oh, we're all connected. You know what I mean? Some platitude, right? It's like, I am literally connected to that tree and the sky. Yeah. And it's a thought provoking experience. I mean, it really is. And that's, I guess the best way to say it is it really flips. It breaks down all those mental barriers, just smashes them. They're gone. They don't exist.
Diana, you brought up something, and this is probably one of the things that I would have fears about. And you talked about, you know, meeting God or speaking to entities, and I'm sure it's open to each individual person's interpretation. But what do you feel that people that experience that are actually interacting with? Do you feel like they're entities, or is that just a part of their mind that they're interacting with?
So the entities thing is a tough one for me. I personally don't believe in evil. I don't believe that that if we have a loving God, that a loving God would create evil. So I don't believe in evil demons and entities and stuff like that. So I think that one's hard for me to answer for other people. But as far as like meeting God, before so I grew up in a Christian household, and in my late teens, I just was like, this is all bullshit. And I really went away from all kind, like everything. I did not believe there was a God for decades. And then I got into psychedelics and I'm like, there's definitely a God. I don't know what it is. But I am a very spiritual person now, which I absolutely was not prior to this. So meeting God, I think that happens in a lot of different ways for people. I guess some people actually meet a thing, like an entity that they believe is God. For me, that hasn't happened. It's just kind of the awe of existence, of the universe, of the unexplained, of the vastness that, like, to me, that's God. And every time I do psychedelics, I am in awe and I have bliss. Like, it's love. People talk about love and blissful love. That's what you get with psychedelics. And I get it in meditation now too. Like, I know how to reach that state through meditation. And it's like having an orgasm in your heart. Like, it's incredible. And I don't have another word other than God. Well, I call it source, or, you know, God. I don't know what else to call it.
It's a lot like if you've ever been around an infant, right? And you just watch them and look at them, and they're looking at things, and everything to them is just awe-inspiring. Everything, yeah. Right? Because it's all new, and it's just like, wow, you know, that I feel like that's the state your mind gets put into. Everything, yeah, is like, wow, you know.
Yeah.
It just breaks down. And you think about it, a baby doesn't have barriers, right? There's no barrier there. There's no trauma. There's no, you know, or there shouldn't be. I hope there isn't. But, you know, there's no barrier there, right? There's no learned behavior to protect from this, or, oh, these words are not good words, or, you know, whatever that. All that's just gone. It's an interesting thing. So, switching topics just a little bit, billionaireism. Okay, so I was doing a little bit of research, and I looked at your book, and I think you may have hit on something, because I've wondered this quite a lot throughout my life, right? Like, for me, if I made $1 billion, you'd never see me again. Just, you wouldn't. Bye. Gone. I'd be like, I'd have 1,000 acres. My house would be in the middle of it. And I might even just not make a road. Like, just no more. Just it. I'm gone. And you equated it to kind of a, if I recall correctly, a mental illness similar to hoarding. And I've never really heard it put that way, but I've always thought to myself, what keeps these, what is the point? Like, you've made so much, you could never even spend all this money. What is the point?
Yeah, and it doesn't add to their well-being, right? Like, I like to talk about the definition of enough. What is your definition of enough? And for me, it's like, if I get more, if it doesn't add to my well-being, but it takes away from somebody else's, then that's too much, right? And these billionaires, they're taking and taking and taking. It's not adding to their well-being, because like you said, they can't spend it in a thousand lifetimes, so they can buy whatever they want. They have all this power. It's not adding to their life anymore, but it's definitely taking away from the rest of us. So yeah, that's a mental illness.
It certainly seems to meet that criteria. And I've never even thought about it like that. So I think that's an interesting thing. So what kind of led you to the idea of billionaireism and the idea that it's potentially grounded in a mental illness?
Like I said, the whole concept of the book came in meditation. So I don't really know when I started thinking about billionaires. I grew up really poor, like eating out of garbage cans poor. So I know what it feels like to watch other people have stuff and you not have it. So obviously that's part of, you know, how my brain works. And like that's back there, the inequality. So that's always, and I've always been kind of an activist. But as far as the billionaire stuff, I feel like just in the last 10 or 15 years, the especially in the US, like just the adoration of these people, you know, like we put them on pedestals and we want to be like them. And I just, I find it sickening. It really makes me sick that these are the people that we're looking up to. And I just think that it's so wrong.
I think any celebrity could be probably put in that category as well. It's crazy that people will listen to a celebrity even though they know nothing about them or what their morals or ideals are. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And these billionaires have so much power. Like they're not elected and they have, like, I don't know. I won't be able to like talk, you know, give the points he gave, but John Oliver just did a segment on Elon Musk and Twitter, and he still calls it Twitter, which I love about John Oliver. But like watching that, you're just like, holy shit. Like stuff that I had no idea about. And it's just, it's scary as shit that they have that kind of power. Not being elected. No consequences whatsoever for these people.
Well, the interesting thing to me is that, and celebrities really, you know, drive this home as well, is in general in our lives, trust is not something you just give, right? There's a process where you meet someone and you know, a little bit of trust is there. Okay, well, you know, go ahead and not just be standoffish with everyone. So, you know, there's some trust and then it builds, right? And you build that trust until this becomes someone that you can trust. When they say something, you feel, I can trust this. With celebrities and with these, you know, these uber wealthy people, it's a weird thing to see, but people just give them their trust just right off the bat. And it's like, you don't know anything about this person. And if you did, you probably would think real, real hard about that trust that you're giving this person. And it's just a weird phenomenon to me to see that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Seems very, very counterproductive to, you know, the way we are in general.
Well, I think we think that we know these people because they're on our screens, right? Like we are always on screens, whatever screen it is, and they're in your home. And I think people feel like they know these people. You don't. You don't know them at all. And they don't know you, that's for sure.
Nor do they care to. Believe it or not,
exactly.
They could care.
Yeah.
Right. They have zero concern for you or your plights or any of that stuff, right? I mean, they may have a rare humanitarian moment here or there, but, you know, that's just PR.
For a tax break, maybe.
Right. It's and PR, right? Oh, look at this great thing I did. I'm so great.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you're.
And I kind of feel sorry for these people a little bit because how do you ever know that someone's truly your friend if you have that much money and they're not just like there for something? I'm sure they're always being pulled at for something or another. And you could probably never tell who your true friends are in life.
Right. And that's gotta be a mental challenge too, right? So like they need therapy. They need therapy to deal with that stuff too. And I think that I don't know any billionaires. I don't know if they're in therapy or not, but they should be. They definitely should be.
Yeah, in your book as well, right? Part of the whole thing is, I don't think I'm giving it away, but essentially kidnapping billionaires and taking them to a camp and going through psychedelic therapy to hopefully change some of their thoughts, beliefs, patterns, etc. Okay, that's a little radical there, right? I mean, on one hand, I sit there and look at it and go, okay, that would probably be beneficial. And then on the other hand, I go, that's like forced conversion therapy right there. Mm-hmm. And that's a scary thing as well, right? I mean, so I would wrestle with that quite a lot, writing something like that, knowing that deep down, I don't believe that that's an approach that should ever be taken, but at the same time, maybe it would work. So did you have to wrestle with that, like morally and ethically, or?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I kind of look at it in two ways. The first being like with alcoholics and drug addicts, there a lot of people have interventions for them, right? So like a lot of addicts don't want help. But then their family intervenes and they're forced into rehab. So I see it kind of that way in some respects. But in the book, there's actually quite a bit of time spent getting the billionaires on board, because with psychedelics, like, it's not a good idea to force somebody to take them, especially if they're angry. And that does come up in the book. What happens when somebody takes psychedelics when they're angry? There's a lot of time spent actually getting them to agree to it. So it's not, so they're coerced into it. They're not forced. It's a little bit different, but like I have a discussion guide for like book clubs, and the discussion guide really goes into stuff like that. Like, is this actually a good thing to do? Is it moral to require somebody to do this type of stuff? Yeah. So it's something that readers would need to wrestle with as well.
Interesting.
I need to write that one down. Don't take psychedelics when you're angry. Got it. That's important for me.
Set and setting.
Yeah.
Those are the two things.
Set and setting.
This is
exact mindset.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's your mindset when you're going into it, and then the setting you're in. Which, you know, I've always been interested in the medical portion of this, right? Because for me, a real big part of this is being in an environment that I'm comfortable in. And I can tell you one place I am never, ever, ever comfortable in any way, shape, or form. And that's in a medical setting. So I'm like, well, I don't know how that would work. I kind of want to try it just to see, like, you know, what would it be like?
Well, it's
like?
Not really a medical setting. So like with a therapist, it's not most therapists have a really nice setting, you know, like almost like a massage, you know, with the candles and the music and that kind of, it does not feel like a sterile medical setting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, music. I'm sure there's good music to go with that stuff. Like,
oh yeah.
Music, like Tool?
Really important.
No. Here's what you really want to do. Here's a good one for you. Most people would probably put this album on and just go, I why would you ever subject yourself to this? Take psychedelics, wait 45 minutes to 1 hour, no longer than 1 hour. And put on Pink Floyd's Umaguma.
I knew you were going to say that.
And I'm not kidding you. It's a ride, man. It's a ride. I think it was purpose built for that. I really do. It just takes you through so many different. So here's an interesting thing on psychedelics. The smallest change can be profound. And I really mean this. If you are sitting in a room and you walk into the next room, the air changes. Everything changed. It's like everything changed. It's like you just got transported to a different planet or something. And it's just my only advice, stay away from mirrors. Mirrors not good. Just
mirrors are awful. Avoid mirrors. Yep. Do not look. When you go to the bathroom, do not look in the mirror.
Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah. That's in the book too.
Really? Yeah. I'm curious now. What's that all about?
It's just,
you remember Raiders of the Lost Ark at the end?
Oh no.
They open the ark.
Yeah. Oh no. That, like, your face melts? Oh no. That's terrible. Oh, yeah.
It doesn't necessarily melt, but it's moving and it's doing some wild stuff
really?
That it doesn't normally do, and it's a weird, yeah, it's uncomfortable. Yeah.
Just the thought of that is absolutely frightening to me. Maybe I'm in the not probably I shouldn't touch that stuff.
No, just don't look in the mirror, and if you do, look away. Just don't focus on it.
But MDMA doesn't do that. MDMA, if you're cleared by a doctor to take MDMA, I highly recommend MDMA as your first experience, because it's very, very rare to have a bad trip. There's not a lot of visuals. It's just heart opening. It's blissful. It's like, it's really hard to describe it to somebody who hasn't felt that, but like I was saying, like an orgasm in your heart. It's just like peaceful and beautiful and loving. So for a first experience, that's the way I'd go.
Yeah, MDMA is like it's like taking LSD with no visuals, is kind of how I would describe it.
Yeah.
Really, just, yeah, that. I'm kind of partial to the visuals myself. I like the visuals, man. they're pretty epic. It's like, wow, that's so cool.
We're getting banned from YouTube, aren't we?
I mean, I literally sat there and looked at like, I was at a construction site one time, and there's just like where they, you know, graded a road, and all the dirt's piled up on one side, and there's just dirt clods and stuff. And I sat down and stared at dirt clods for probably 2 hours. Dirt clods.
Yeah, I stared at like my shirt and like all the stitching, and like, it's incredible.
Yeah. It really is. It really is.
Yeah.
So, was there a reason you chose Canada for the location of your camp in the book?
I am Canadian, so I have I have a fondness for my country, but also it's a place like in the middle of the prairies where there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing for hundreds of miles. So it was a place where the, you know, it's near future. So climate change has, you know, done a little bit more to the planet than it is now. So, you know, the temperatures aren't as horrible in the winter there in the near future. So it was just a place where there was nobody around and people could still go outside year round.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Maybe I should move to Canada.
I don't.
Are you guys full? I let everybody know. Don't come here. That's what we try to do in Florida. Like, we're full. Don't come here. We don't want you.
If you can't take our weather, there's not a chance for your survival in Canada, dude.
No, I would freeze to death.
Like, North Carolina is way too cold. That's whole nother level. Whole nother level.
Yeah.
Like 60 something, and I'm for shivering.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd never live.
never. So, what's your favorite part about the book? What portion of it like was the most exciting for you when you came to the time to write it, etc.?
The trips. I loved writing the trips. Yeah, it's like that was like the most creative part. Trying to imagine what a billionaire's trip would consist of and trying to write that in a way that, I mean, like trying to describe a psychedelic experience to somebody who's never had one is hard. It's really hard. And to make it feel like Yeah, that I could see that happening for somebody to read it and to imagine the trip. It's really hard, but it was a lot of fun. Yeah.
It sounds like it.
What do billionaires trip about? Like hanging out with world leaders and changing policies and like all that kind of thing?
Scrooge McDuck's vault. That's what they trip on. They're like, oh, piles of gold I can swim in.
Nah, dude, I would think you have enough money. You don't even think about money. Like it really isn't even a thing anymore.
Yeah. Well, like in the book, it's therapy. It's not the heroic doses. So it's them dealing with their own trauma, because I believe they probably have had trauma.
Oh,
like,
I'm sure.
Why are they the way they are? We are all. I believe that every human being on the planet has had trauma. Nobody escapes, right? So they have their shit that needs to be dealt with. Mm. So all that comes up, and yeah, and nature, connection to nature, seeing what they're doing to the planet. Yeah.
Interesting.
Because the whole concept of the book is to make them solve climate change. They don't get to go home until they solve climate change after their psychedelic stuff.
Well, that's an incentive there, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's an interesting one. I could think of a couple of easy ways to reduce its impact pretty easily and quickly.
Yeah. You know,
like,
yeah.
I don't know. You know, stop.
No private jets.
I would go to like the bigger polluters, like, you know, bombing things and, you know, things of nature.
Or shooting rockets into space. Yeah.
Yeah. Bombing oil depots and things of that nature. And, you know,
yeah.
Yeah. And flying jets around that burn through fuel that, you know, I would say we could probably, like, if we just got rid of that stuff, we could take a break. We'd be in darn good shape, yeah. Right? But, you know, I
talk about that all the time. Like I go on podcasts about climate change and I'm like, we are focused on the wrong people. We're trying to change the behavior of 8 billion people. That's really hard to change the behavior of 8 billion, like take shorter showers, don't use plastic straws, don't, you know, all this stuff that we're told to do. But there's roughly 3,200 billionaires in the world. And if they changed their behavior, climate change would be solved. So why are we focusing on 8 billion instead of 3,200? That's what I don't understand. But that's because they have the power. They create the systems that benefit them. So things aren't going to change if they're the ones with the power.
So you don't think it's beneficial to have them all fly their own personal private jets to Davos once a year so that they can talk about how climate to tax us into being better stewards of the planet? You think that's counterproductive a little bit, maybe? Just tiny
yeah.
bit? Like, I have Zoom and Teams. I frequently meet with people all over the planet.
Right
here, face to face. I can see their reaction.
Yep.
I can see what they're doing, you know?
Yeah.
I think you're thinking about this the wrong way, because if you have enough money, you just like let things play out. And then when it's no longer sustainable, just go to Mars. It's easy. Easy solution.
But Mars has no resources. That's another thing. It's like they're spending billions of dollars to, you know, to go to Mars and we're going to colonize Mars that has no water, no oxygen, instead of taking the billions of dollars that they're spending on that and working together and fixing this. For, you know, we have a beautiful planet. This planet is abundant. There is enough for everyone on this planet if 3,200 people didn't take all the resources for themselves.
I would say that there's still more than enough for everyone on the planet, but you know, I'm also, to be quite honest, I'm very skeptical on the whole climate change. I do believe that there is a huge capacity and a lot of room for improving what we do, but you know, I don't necessarily believe I don't believe a lot of the hype. behind it, right? Okay, so here's the red flag for me. The second you come up and you start saying, well, I'm going to tax you to solve climate change, I go, there, you've right there discounted anything, right? Because that's a non sequitur, right? That's not carbon credits. Come on, really? I'm sorry, but no. Right now, I'm a big fan of, you know, plastics, reduce or eliminate plastics in your life. You know, try and reduce chemical inputs everywhere. Like I'm a farmsteader. LX is a homesteader, and we grow our food, and we also raise livestock, and this all occurs with zero chemical or agrochemical input, zero, right? We take the compost from the manure from the animals and we use that. That is our fertilizer for the most part. When we do add any kind of a fertilizer, it's a purely organic fertilizer, which typically consists of bunny poop and some minerals and some things of that nature, right?
Alpaca poop.
Yeah, alpaca poop. It's a great one. I think there's a lot of room for doing these things, and I think that makes us better stewards of the planet. Monoculture ag is just terrible, right? It's absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
That said, when it comes to the climate change thing, I think there's been too much hype on this, and I tend to fall into the more cynical George Carlin thing on this. Like, the planet's fine. Planet's gonna be fine. It will be. We're not saving the planet from anything. The planet's gonna be 100% okay. I think there's also a lot of room for, I know everybody wants to get that clickbait, that shock, that, let me get you to be interested in this thing. But I think that gets watered down and diluted when it's this shock that is like, it falls flat, right? Save the planet. The planet's not going anywhere, Save humans.
But what about save humanity?
There you go. Save humanity. Save humans, right? That I would say. But we saw even in the pandemic, right? You take people and you get them off the roads and you do this kind of stuff.
That's amazing.
And all of a sudden, the earth comes back. And it's like, hey, I'm here. We think way too highly of ourselves to think that we could ever destroy the planet. We really can't. It's going to be fine.
We need another pandemic.
No.
I was so hopeful during the pandemic. I really thought that was going to be the catalyst for humanity to wake up and go, oh, this is how we're supposed to be. Mm. Yeah, that didn't happen.
No. I'm very big on, doing things that are local to you that can change these things. And I even go so far as plant a tomato plant. If you like tomatoes, if you don't like tomatoes, whatever you do like eating, plant one just on your balcony if you live in an apartment. It's so tiny, but that little fraction, if you eat two tomatoes that you don't buy from the store, you've put a dent in that supply line, right? All of that, those moving pieces. And the more people do that, the better I think we all will be. Plus, you'll get to taste what a tomato really tastes like. And I promise you,
right? It's actually red.
If you've never had one off the vine, like, you cannot get one like this in a store. There is no store that can deliver this experience to you. Go find someone that grows tomatoes, grab one off the vine, and take a taste of that tomato. And I guarantee you, it doesn't taste like what you've been eating as tomatoes, right?
Mm.
So I think there's a lot of, I'm in complete agreement with those types of things and the actions, limit your pollution, limit these types of things. Mm-hmm. The climate thing is, the problem that I have with it is there's no definitive causal, right, that we can point to. We can say, yes,
we can see humanity's effect.
We can say that these things are ecologically not good. We can say that they definitely impact systems, but I don't think that we can say that as a whole, the entire system is impacted in a way that actually shifts things. And we also have a very, very minute amount of recorded data, which means that all of our basis of this is in a period of time that doesn't even account for one real cycle of change, which would be 10,000 years. We don't have 10,000, like 100 and some odd, maybe up to 300 if you go back to some old, old records. But we don't have solid, good data that goes back and we can say, yeah, 10,000 years ago, oh, hey, maybe this is more of a cycle, right? These are cyclical things. And we've seen that. We've been able to prove that through, you know, carbon dating. We've been able to prove that through, ice cores, where we could sit there and look at what the mixture of the gases on the planet were at any specific mm-hmm. time. And, you know, you hear about, carbon dioxide, and it's like, okay, yeah, but it's been far higher and things have thrived, right? So there's a lot of things there that make me go, look, there's definitely room. And there should be studies on these things. They should continue. But I haven't seen any of them come back and definitively go, this is the causal source and it is humans. And there's a lot of speculation, and, you know, but it doesn't hold up as a system approach, right? Is kind of where I'm at. So I'm waiting on better scientific data. And in the meantime, what I will say is I'll champion the cause of let's reduce pollution. Let's reduce these types of inputs that we know are dangerous and bad. They're bad for you. Like, if nothing else, just think, forget about that right. whole other argument and just go, look, these things are bad for your body, you, your health. So make a change yeah. for you and your family. Mm. Don't worry about all the other stuff. And if people yeah. started to take that approach, a lot of this other stuff would start to diminish in what we see as something that's potentially capable of altering life on Earth.
I totally agree with some of the stuff that you're saying, but I feel like that's still putting the onus on all of us instead of the onus on the people that can actually affect change. So like the plastics, right? Like I personally use a shampoo bar and bar soap because I don't want plastic in my bathroom. But it's the companies that are still allowed to produce the stuff that we shouldn't be using. Like that's where the change needs to come in, is like, why are we allowing these companies to produce chemicals that are killing us? Why are they allowed to put this crap in our food that's killing us? Why are they allowed these, you know, the feedlots and stuff that are killing their neighbors? That's where the change is really going to happen. And I agree, like I love gardens, you know, people growing their own food. I think that's fantastic, and do that for sure. And do everything that you can as an individual, because I always say hope is a consequence of action. So for me to have hope in my life, I do things, and the things that I do make me feel better about my life and who I am and what I'm doing in society. But the systems have to change.
Sure.
Because as much as we do on our own, it's not going to make that much of a difference except to ourselves.
Well, there's also, you know, a lot of burdens that get placed that shouldn't be there, right? Like we can create plastics out of hemp that biodegrade.
Yeah, and mushrooms.
That biodegrade. And it's like, yeah. But there's so many regulatory hurdles to get over to be able yep. to do this stuff. And
exactly.
that right there is so, I mean, we could change yeah. the industry by just getting over that hurdle. Right, we can change a lot of industry. Yeah. You know, textiles, another one with hemp. Right, here's literally mm-hmm. a weed that just grows. Yeah. If you put it in the ground, it will yeah. grow. Maybe not great, and you know, maybe not the desired outcome for a lot of people doing this. But in general, for you know, stock, for you know, creating, you know, plastics or hempcrete or, you know, textiles, yeah, et cetera, it will grow. It doesn't need a lot of input. And it plays perfectly into a permaculture scenario as well. Just tons of chop and drop foliage, right? so, yeah. I always like to make it actionable for myself, though, right? Like, I can think about, mm-hmm, what can I do to change these 3,200 people that happen to be powerful enough to influence and or create policy, which I can't. Or I can think about, well, you know what? For me, I can't do that. But what I can do is I can stop buying this garbage. I can stop, you know, funding these people. I can start doing things in my own life that reduce their, you know, sales. They reduces their, and, yeah, you know, I mean, honestly, you know, if we as a society were to start voting with that, like, we're not doing it unless you change, you know, I don't want these plastic bottles, make hemp plastic. Right. And I'm not going to buy it until you do. You know, they would change, right? That's, I think there's a lot of room for bottom up as well, right?
For sure. I agree with that. But there's also the fact that there are a lot of poor people who can't make those choices. So they have to buy what's cheap, and what's cheap is plastic crap from China. It's, mm-hmm, it's junk food. It's, you know, it's not healthy stuff, and they don't have a garden to grow, yeah, tomatoes. So I absolutely agree that we all need to do whatever we can as individuals. But I also believe that we have to start changing the narrative. And that's what I want to do with the book, is change the narrative to we the people have the power, and not these 3,200 people.
You're right about the food stuff, because, yeah, like a half dozen zucchini or, you know, organic squash is like $6, or you can buy two gigantic bags of potato chips for $5. That's,
oh yeah,
yeah, right. Yeah. That's how they, yeah, get you in there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's.
Yeah, they're definitely poisoning us.
Yeah, without, mm-hmm, question. And legally, which, yeah, is great. Awesome. Thanks, guys. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I just lost my brain again. It just went away. It's over there somewhere. Alex, you got anything?
That happens to me all the time, but I have menopause to blame for that. I don't know what your excuse is.
Did the psychedelics help with menopause? Maybe I should get my wife on board with this whole thing, huh? She's probably going to be mad, yeah, I brought that up.
Well, I think psychedelics help with a lot of things.
I was just thinking our next get-together, maybe you should have invite Elon down, you know. I don't know.
Dose him up.
Yeah, sit around the campfire and, yeah, get them going. I don't know.
No offense, but I don't
really, probably a no show.
I don't want anything to do with them, to be honest with you.
All, so, right.
Yeah, no thanks.
Maybe he's a nice guy. You don't know.
I don't care, honestly. I just don't. I'm not going to say anything, you know, one way or the other than just, I'm not his biggest fan. Right. I'm, you know, certainly not like anti Elon. I think he has done some things that are, you know, in some way, shape or form, you know, maybe beneficial. Right. Like the whole rockets thing. Okay. Yeah. But we're going to fire rockets anyway. So at least now the dang things can be reused and we're not like redoing them every single time. So there's some benefit. EVs, I think are, yeah, my opinion of EVs is not a good one. Right. I don't think the NIMBY thing is the way to go about changing things. And if you take some time and research them and look at the, you know, massive toxic lakes and the damage.
We could go back to horses.
The damage that comes from mining this stuff and then refining it or extracting it, et cetera, is insane. Like, we would never tolerate that in our country. right? Like no town would be like, oh, hey, yeah, there's that lake. And if you go, you know, you can't go past that fence because if you get too close of it, you're just going to die of some radical disease or something. You know what I mean?
But we allow other stuff to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the funny thing about that, right, is I remember when I was younger, I was living next door to a gentleman and he was driving this go-kart around. That's all he did all day is he would be in his garage and he did the stuff and he'd drive this go-kart around. And finally, one day I went out there and I'm like, hey, you know, what are you doing? What is this? And he goes, oh, he goes, well, this is a hydrogen motor.
Oh,
and I'm
wow.
Like, what? And he goes, yeah. And I'm like, well, I don't get it, right? So he started explaining it to me, and I'm like, really? And he goes, yeah, and like the tailpipe, there's, you know, a little bit of like water coming out of it. And he goes, yeah, and he held his hand under it, and he goes, like that. And I'm like, wow. Ooh. And he goes, no, it's just water. It's it. It's all the output is. And, you know, we've had this technology. We know how to make it safe.
Right.
It's
yeah.
You know, why would we go to something like EVs when something like this really solves that problem? Quick, efficient to fuel up, you know, you could do it at home, just like you can plug your EV in at home. Same thing. You're going to use electricity to create the hydrogen, et cetera. So, you know, again, there's these things. I look at like thorium reactors, right? Instead of these giant windmills where we've got these graveyards of, you know, carbon composite materials that can't be recycled, they can't be broken down, so they just go into the earth because that's great, I guess. But, you know, you look at these and it's like, you know, the best of intentions, right? We're going to go with renewable energy, but the problem is we're like creating worse destruction and pollution creating these things that create that energy than we ever get back from that energy. Whereas a thorium reactor, you know, it can be small, contained, put in a neighborhood. Every neighborhood could have one. They could all be grid into, you know, grid tied together. So if one goes down, the others take the load. They kind of self-manage themselves. The danger profile is almost zero. The fuel rods that we're now storing in some mountain in a desert because can't do anything else with them. What the heck are we going to do? We got like 10,000 plus years before they're going to be good. You could feed those into a thorium reactor and turn that into a half-life that's 300 years once they're spent through a thorium reactor. So, you know, we've got all these things that could be done that would benefit humanity as well as take care of the environment, right? But we don't.
It's all about money.
Exactly.
It's all about money. And yes, the funding, right? It's, yeah, there's some amazing stuff being produced right now. Like I look at mycelium. There's, I can't remember the name of the company, but they're doing so much stuff with mycelium, and mycelium is abundant and cheap, but there's no funding for them. And they're competing against other people for the same resources, mm-hmm. right? So like all these companies that have these amazing ideas that would absolutely work, they're competing against each other for very limited funds. We need to have all of these people working together to solve these things. Yeah, so they're not competing for limited amount of money, and we need the billionaires to be putting money into these things.
No, I completely agree. That I can agree with, right? And yeah, you know, maybe it's something, you know, be kind of cool to see the billionaires start a new project, and each of them just take 1/1,000th of your wealth and put it into a fund, and that fund goes to fund startups that are doing things like the mycelium stuff. Mycelium's amazing too. I mean, they have, it's a living organism, right? And they have found webs of it that go for miles and miles and yeah. miles. And the interesting
the largest living organism is mycelium in Oregon. Yeah.
And they've found that interacting with it in one area spreads that message to all of the mycelium. Yep. That whole mycelial layer is like a communications network, right? It's pretty amazing stuff. I mean, I get all excited about plant stuff.
Is it like sentient and stuff?
I do too.
There's some conjecture about that. Yeah, honestly.
Really?
Yeah. There is. That
some people think it's alien. Yeah.
That it's I mean, it is alive. It communicates. If you harm a portion of it, it sends out signals to let the rest of the network know that harm is coming. And there's a good chance that in some way, shape, or form, this thing has the capacity to, I don't want to say think, right? But to interact with the environment around it and understand that environment, I guess.
How much do you got to mess with it before it gets angry and comes after you? That's what I'd be worried about.
I don't want to find out. It's good stuff.
Isn't that The Last of Us?
Right? That's right.
The show The Last of Us. That's the mushrooms fighting back.
Yeah. It makes really good berries, though. So, you know, I'm not going to mess with it. I'm trying to feed it. That's what I'm going to do. Hopefully not with me. At least not for a while. You know, eventually, I'm sure.
I don't know why this came to my head, but you guys were talking about the climate change, and while they were giving us the don't do drugs shirts, they were also talking about the holes in the ozone. We're not even supposed to be here by 2000, are we?
But we fixed it. But because of science, we fixed the hole in the ozone.
Oh,
we
it's fixed now? I don't even follow that
pretty
stuff.
Much,
yeah.
All right. We figured out the science and we fixed it.
Reduced the amount of carbon fluorocarbons we were putting into the atmosphere. Yeah. Which
Oh, is that what that was for? Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yep.
In large part, it's not in total. There's always
still a hole, but it's way smaller.
There's always going to be a hole. My understanding is there always has been, and there always will be some form of hole there. But that's a more natural phenomenon, whereas the CFCs were really kind of widening that thing in a bad way.
So, yeah,
it's a good area.
Yes, well,
I think. This is probably a good place to wrap up. First and foremost, so your book, where is there a preferred place to buy it?
I'll just hold it up.
There you go.
There it is.
Awesome. Oh,
there it is.
Nice.
Is there a preferred place to buy it? Like, do you have your website, or is it just Amazon's fine? Or
so I'm very torn about saying where to buy it, because Amazon is where I make the most money. Like, I, as the author, I get more if you buy it from Amazon than anywhere else. But I also hate supporting Amazon. I don't know what to do there. But it is available pretty much anywhere books are sold. You can go to any indie bookstore and have them order it for you if they don't have it, like, in their store, you know. Yeah, pretty much everywhere. I don't sell it directly from my website. That's something probably down the line that I'll do. But I do have, if you sign up for my newsletter on my website, you get a free download of the discussion guide that goes along with the book, which is also for sale on Amazon, the discussion guide. But if you want it for free, you can get it from my website. And even if you're not in a book club, there's like just reading through the questions in that discussion guide is really eye-opening, and it makes you really think about what you believe. And so I highly recommend doing that. And if you are in a book club, I would love to come to your meeting. You know, like if your listeners have a book club and they read the book, I will come to the book club's discussion if they want me there to answer any questions and talk about it.
That's awesome. Yeah. And what is your website?
It's just DianaColleenAuthor.com.
All right. There you go. Her name's right there. It's on the little box with her name. And so you just type that in, author.com.
Author.
Try to make it very simple.
Yeah.
You know, if any of the audience is like me, we're going to need very explicit instructions for this. No, I'm kidding. I love y'all. all right. And then... what are you working? You got any other projects going on? What are you doing? Where can people follow you, find your work, etc.?
Yeah. We just started a Substack. There's just so many things for authors to do. It's like, it's overwhelming, the social media and all that. So I am everywhere on social media, but the Substack is where I'm going to write short pieces. I think I've got three up there right now. Just random stuff, a lot about billionaires. There's going to be stuff about me. And it's called A Reckoning of Sorts. The Substack is called A Reckoning of Sorts. And yeah, and I've got this book. I've been marketing it as a standalone, but there is another one after this. There's actually, it's a trilogy.
Oh, nice.
So I'm working on the second book right now, and it's a lot. I'm biting off a lot for the second book. I think it's going to be even more controversial than this one.
Awesome. That's the best kind of stuff. Be controversial.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So, throughout our lives, we're impacted by someone, an author, but, you know, could be anyone, sixth grade science teacher, an author, a historical figure, mom, could be anyone. And we like to give our guests the opportunity to shout out to that one person that made a huge impact in your life.
I think as an author, like we're influenced by what we read, and as an adult, the book that had the most influence on me, so the author of that book is Daniel Quinn, and his book was called Ishmael, and that book influenced how I live my life, and it influenced my writing, and I think it should be required reading for everyone. So that's who I would say.
Awesome. Yeah. Oh, very cool. Thank you so much for giving some of your time to us. We really do appreciate it, and really enjoyed having you on the show. It's been a great conversation, and
it's been really fun.
I'd love to have you back when you complete your next book.
I'd love to come back. Thank you so much for having me on your show. It's been great.
Awesome, Alex. Anything you want to wrap up with?
No, I think we're good. I had a great time.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us for another episode of the Space Tomatoes podcast. You know where you can find us everywhere. We are now on fountain.fm as well. If you appreciate our work, you can go there. It's a value for value or podcast 2.0 app. So you can, you know, drop a couple pennies or something our way if you'd care to or not. And as always, if you liked it, give us a thumbs up. If you didn't, give us a thumbs down, leave a comment, tell us we suck. We don't care. But we will respond. And that might be fun. So, hey, if you have an idea or a topic for the show, give us a shout. You can find us on our Telegram group. You can find us online. And now you can find us on fountain.fm, where we have a chat group set up. So,
Noster. Don't forget Noster.
And Noster. Yeah, Noster. The protocol where you own your identity and your account. And remember, wherever you are, whenever you're watching this, have an amazing day.
See you, everybody.